It sounds like a scene from a horror movie. An excavation crew in Sugar Land, Texas, was preparing the site of a new career center campus for the Fort Bend Independent School District when a backhoe operator came upon a buried bone that looked suspiciously human. In the days to come, it happened again, and again, and again, until a total of 95 sets of human remains had been pulled from this ground, even though there was no official record of a cemetery located there. Who were these people? How did they die? And who consigned them to spend eternity in unmarked graves? From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are still plenty of questions unanswered in this case, but the core facts take us back to a shameful era in Texas history, when a sort of loophole in post-Civil War laws allowed for prison inmates to be forced to work, sometimes work to death, for the profit of landowners still fuming over the defeat of the Confederacy. Journalists Brittany Martin and Naomi Reed investigated that history and its legacy in the 21st century for their Texas Newsroom podcast, Sugarland, which is available now. Brittany and Naomi, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Brittany, we'll start with you. Who had owned that land before the Fort Bend Independent School District?
So it goes back pretty far. We dug very deep into this. It was originally owned by some slave owners back in the early 1800s when Stephen F. Austin's Old 300 settled there. It was passed from their hands to convict lease owners or convict leasers from the penitentiary. And then it was sold to the state of Texas, where they ran the Central State Farm there. And it was owned by the state of Texas for a very long time until about 2003, I want to say, when it was sold to a developer called Newland to build a new neighborhood called Telfair in Sugarland. And it was owned by the developer, and they were building houses all around it until 2011 when Fort Bend ISD bought the land.
So, Naomi, it sounds like there had been a lot of development around the site, but maybe not in this particular area. Whose responsibility was it to determine what should happen to those human remains once they were unearthed?
Ultimately, the people who own the land have to deal with the remains if they discover them during construction. So Fort Bend ISD owned the land. They were starting to build their new school, and they had an archaeologist come and survey the land. And so when they found the remains, it was completely their responsibility to figure out, are they human remains? And then when they figure that out, you know, they had to decide what to do with the remains. There's a lot of protocol as far as like who they should consult about what to do with the remains, which in the podcast, we kind of discuss whether or not they followed that. But ultimately, if you own the land, it falls on your back to clean it up, basically.
The only oversight is from like the Texas Historical Commission, which is the state agency in charge of making sure historical sites are kept up. And the Texas Historical Commission said Fort Bend ISD did everything they were supposed to do.
They did everything they were supposed to do by what, hiring an archaeologist to sort of test the land. That archaeologist didn't happen to find any of these bodies, right?
Right.
Right.
The first time, yeah.
Right. Yeah, he monitored for about 3 months and didn't see any remains.
We should say this cannot have come as a complete surprise to leaders in Sugarland, right? This local resident named Reginald Moore did know the basic history of the area and would not stop talking about it.
Yeah, he, far back as the late 90s, had been very loud about the potential of bodies being there. And so when they discovered them, their reaction, I would say a lot of people following this, a lot of people who are supporters of Reginald Moore, kind of found their reaction problematic to act as though they were surprised, even though they'd had lots of warning for decades from, Reginald Moore, who had for the longest time been dismissed. And he wasn't just sort of, you know, talking out of nowhere. He had lots of research, he had done archival work, he had done, he was definitely sort of an organic intellectual. And if they had listened to him, this would not be the case at all.
How did this become a cause celebre for Reginald Moore? What was his background and why did he get so interested in this aspect of the local history?
So in the I think mid to late 80s, I think it was 85 to 88, there was an economic slump, and he, I think, was laid off from his job as a longshoreman on the ship channel. And he started working for or at the what is it called? Jester unit, I think.
Chester.
Yes. As a prison guard. And when he was there, he just started learning about the history of these huge prison farms in Fort Bend County. And he started to notice how the things he was reading in history really mirrored what he was seeing in the prisons today. And he felt that the prisoners that he was overseeing were really treated very much like slaves. And that bothered him so much that he ended up devoting the last few decades of his life into getting this recognized.
So we should go back to the history here. Will you outline for us how convict leasing came to be so common after the Civil War?
Basically, when slavery ends, the economy of Texas in particular is really bad. And so they're trying to figure out ways to maintain their sort of agricultural ways without having to pay people to do that work. So ultimately, they create, as you mentioned earlier, a sort of a loophole, in order to still have free labor, right? So we don't have slaves anymore. But there's all kinds of laws, black codes, that are put into place that make it very easy to put black men in particular in jail. And so once they have all of these men in jail, this is, all of these bodies can be useful, right, to work plantations in the same way that slaves once did. So that's sort of where the convict lease system starts, right? The state begins to lease prisoners to plantation owners, farmers. I think you even have situations where people are leased as domestics, which we don't talk about that, but a situation where the state can make money and these individuals can continue to be exploited like they were in slavery. And that really does, I think, kind of resurrect the economy for Texas in particular.
So, who got paid for the lease of convict labor? Was it prisons that profited, or did that money go straight to Austin? How did that work?
Basically, they set up the system so that everyone would get paid. The state brought in money from the lessees. So they picked a company out of Galveston first, and they said, you can give us a bunch of money and we'll give you the prison, essentially. So you can use these men, of which, the population is just growing and growing and growing at this crazy, like, rapid rate. You can use them for their labor and you can keep whatever money they make. So you're paying us for the prison, you're getting paid for the things that they produce, and if you lease them out to people like farmers or railroads, they'll pay you, the lessees. And so essentially, everybody's getting paid except for the convicts themselves.
And I suppose this doesn't even need to be asked, but did convicts have the option to say, no, I don't want to be part of this program, or were they effectively treated like slaves, not just not paid for the work, but compelled to do it whether they wanted to or not?
To this day, they don't have the option to just say no. When you're in prison, you're very much controlled by the whims of the state. And part of the state's idea of rehabilitation, factors in the fact that, like, a person should be working, a person should be learning job skills. And that's how they justify forcing them into these jobs that I'm sure a lot of us wouldn't want to do.
It's instructive to talk about this work now at this moment where we've been gripped by a heat wave for weeks across the state that just will not seem to move on. What do we know about what the working conditions were like on those post-Civil War sugar plantations, such as the ones in Sugar Land?
Well, I mean, there's a reputation of Sugar Land being like hell, right? There's songs, there's like little sayings about it. I think in our episode that we release in 2 days, we talk about that as well. Like the reputation of it being hot and humid and mosquitoes and disease and people dying from heat exhaustion. And of course, nobody who owns the plantations or the farms is really concerned, right, with necessarily hydrating these men or giving them medical care. So, yeah, I think as hot as it is now, I would couple that with torture and extreme labor, and that would be, you know, the situation they were working in.
And I gather it was even less of a concern for the plantation owners that these men be treated in a way that allowed them to survive, because they didn't, pardon the crassness of talking about it this way, they didn't own these human beings, they were leasing them. So if one of them happened to die, they didn't lose anything.
In our episode that comes out on Thursday, we really dig into the history of convict leasing in Texas. And there's this example of the prison inspector going to this one convict camp over and over and over again and being like, they're torturing the men here. There's no clothes for them. There's no water for them. It's terrible. It's dirty. It's inhumane. But then he just goes back month after month after month, and it's the same. There's no consequences for them ultimately because they're paying. And, you know, so yeah, there was just no reason to invest money in the humanity of these prisoners, other than the fact that you want the strongest workforce you can get so that you can get the most work out of them.
Seems like a great incentive for continuing to craft laws to put Black men in particular in prison on kind of trumped up charges too, right? How did this contribute to the system of mass incarceration that we're still trying to untangle and dismantle?
Yeah, I mean, and we do get into this again towards the end of the podcast, but yeah, there's a direct line, I think, from the Black, or we could say from slavery to mass incarceration. You know, everyone is really familiar with the famous thing that Michelle Alexander says, that there's more Black men in prison today than there were under, you know, under slavery. So really, you know, slavery evolving into convict leasing, evolving into mass incarceration is almost a better system than what it once was. And so, no, we don't have Black codes or pig laws anymore, but there have been ways to sort of, you know, indirectly create policies and laws that target certain populations, right? And we're all familiar with that, I think, at this point, right? Sentencing around drugs, you know, racially profiling, you know, a lot of which I will say, you know, in the post George Floyd era, those things have been looked at, but the numbers of mass incarceration remain the same. So,
and how long did convict labor last as a system?
So it started shortly after the Civil War came to an end. I think the first lease to railroads, there were some smaller, like Naomi said, domestic leases, where they're literally just sending female prisoners in particular out to work for like guards at their homes or something, or business owners in Huntsville, which is just next level concerning. But around 1867 is when they leased the first force of convicts out to a railroad to help, you know, build the infrastructure of Texas. And it continued in that official way until 1912. So 1867 to 1912, it's what, like 40, 50 years. And after that, the state took over a lot of the bigger convict lease plantations that were privately run, and they just started running them themselves. So there was the Central State Farm, where our cemetery was found. There's Jester, which used to be Harlem. There's Clemens. There's all kinds of prisons that still exist today that were built on former convict lease plantations.
So these leased convicts often died because of this brutal work they were forced to do. What kinds of records were kept by the prisons of what happened to their inmate populations?
They actually kept decent records. You know, they didn't fill out death certificates for these men, as far as we can tell, because they weren't, you know, worth that much to them, but they did keep track of the incoming convicts and when they escaped, when they died, when they were released, I think mostly so that they could keep track of like what their available workforce was at the time. So when a prisoner died at one of these camps, they wrote in the record, that they died, the date of death, and the cause of death. And it was occasionally reported in the newspaper, though not very often. And we know from archival records that usually families were not notified. Usually the graves were not marked. In our case, they might have been marked with like a wooden headstone, but 100 something years on, that's not there anymore. And there's other testimony that suggests that, especially like on the railroad camps, they're building as they move down a railroad. So if you died, they buried you where you died. And there's really just no record of that. And there's really no way of knowing who would be buried where and how many untold bodies there could be out there along railroads.
So the implication is that there are many other sites like this scattered across the American South.
Yes.
Yeah.
I would say it's the implication, and a lot of people have done work to almost make that proven fact, right? And around, I mean, Sugar Land alone has sites that are not have not been looked at, that could be looked at, where there could be bodies, bodies potentially linked to the Sugar Land 95, right? But then, yeah, other states, I mean, you have the same story with other sorts of companies, other sorts of labor situations. I guess one of the most famous ones that we kind of mentioned early in the podcast was the bricklaying company in Alabama.
I think.
Yeah. But yeah, there's so many. It's not uncommon.
Yeah, this is one of untold number of cemeteries out there. And that just doesn't even take into consideration the people that weren't buried in cemeteries at all.
So it really becomes a question of whether people in power wanted to know about this. I mean, historians have understood that convict leasing was rampant across former Confederate states after the Civil War. This wasn't really part of, like, Sugar Land's official history of itself, right? Not taught in local schools, not much talked about among local folks.
Right. Sugar Land really didn't have an idea of, anything more than a recent past, right? So you would hear about, Sugar Land started in 1959 when it was incorporated as a city. And maybe you would get a little bit of nostalgic kind of folklore about Stephen F. Austin and the development of a company town. But you really, the idea was that, oh, well, this wasn't a place until 1959. So people that grew up around there don't look at Sugar Land as a historical site. Like, you don't ask questions about the past in that place, right? So I think it's definitely come as a shock to young people in particular in Sugar Land, Missouri City, and all of those areas to really ask questions and what was going on here and who was here first, right? It didn't always look like this. But yeah, definitely public education has completely avoided that conversation.
So before these bodies were even officially located, Reginald Moore had been campaigning for some kind of official memorial to convict laborers. Sounds like this was not something local leaders were ever especially interested in. Did they view him as a nuisance?
I would say so. We never got to know Reginald Moore personally, but we've explored his archives and we've listened to hours and hours and hours of his public testimony, his voicemails. He called C-SPAN a lot. We've listened to all of that. We've talked to a lot of people who knew him. And yes, that's the impression we get, is that he was just this very insistent presence in a lot of places, especially Sugar Land City Council, Fort Bend County Commissioners meetings, and even the State Historical Commission meetings. He would show up and he would just say, "Hey, I'm glad to be here. Can I get, memorial for the convict lease plantation or that used to operate on this land?" And they would just, it was so far outside of the things they were considering that it was very easy for them to just ignore him and move on. But he kept coming back for decades.
So after these 95 bodies were discovered, the school district's plan was to get permission to move the remains to some other location and proceed with the project as scheduled, right? Can I assume that it is not legal to just continue apace with construction once human remains have been discovered on a site?
Right. That's what we have been told, that you can't just build over them. I mean, I'm sure there are definitely situations where people don't report it, and so then things do get built. But I think once it's common knowledge, then no, all building, all construction has to stop. But I will say for the Sugarland 95, I think that all comes down to the one construction worker who made it public. You know, if he had made a different decision, I don't think we'd be having this conversation.
Do you know, were you able to speak with that worker?
I've met him once, but he chose not to speak with us for the series. He is lauded as like a hero in Sugarland for sure, because he did stop construction and it was a huge construction project. So for him to be like, hey guys, I think this is a problem, it was really heroic.
Were these bodies buried close together? Like, was it, you know, 10 yards by 10 yards, or were they scattered around a larger area?
It was a pretty large area, but they were mostly buried in a sort of uniform way. So, you know, like one beside another, there seemed to be like different sections of the cemetery. Like maybe they buried, you know, this section in a few years, and then they moved over to the other side and they started burying people over there. So it's a little disjointed, but it's a pretty large area. And you can actually go out to the site today and see the perimeter of it.
So Reginald Moore wanted the bodies left where they were and suggested the school find a new place to put their new complex of buildings. Why didn't the school consider that right away?
Well, the school had already began building, so they already had part of their structure, like, up. And, you know, as they always say time and time again, our number one priority is educating children, not running a cemetery, right? Which is problematic for a number of reasons, because many of the children attending that school probably would have some kind of investment in what happens to these men, as many of them are of color. But they ultimately, I think it was about money, right? They didn't want to have to change their plans. They definitely didn't want to like tear down something they'd already built or buy new land, or you know, just they didn't want to change the path they were on, because it would have been really expensive to do that. I mean, they ultimately did redraw the boundaries of their school to kind of wrap itself around the cemetery. So if you, yeah, Brittany, do you want to describe
it? Even that, I mean, they redesigned the school so that the bodies could be reburied where they were found, but there was, you know, a year of pushback before that happened. So because that cost money to redesign a school and to change their plans, they lost, I think, or they said they were going to lose some like financial partners, like local businesses who wanted to have classes in the part of the building that was changed. And so they were just really trying to avoid having to take those steps. But ultimately, Reginald Moore and the community was so vocal that they had no choice to do so. And yeah, the cemetery, basically you walk up to the school now and you park in the parking lot and you walk up the path and there's just a cemetery to your right. It's a kind of just like a plain grass patch with a chain fence around it, I'd say, or like a chain, yeah, fence-ish area. And on the ground, there are little black tiles over each grave that say unknown number one, unknown number two, and so on up through all 95.
So while the school was considering seeking permission to move these bodies, they came up against this hurdle, right? They had to identify these poor people thrown into unmarked graves a century ago. How do you even begin that process?
So the law, when you want to move bodies, so you want to relocate graves, there's a specific law in Texas that says you have to get permission from somebody's next of kin. So if you wanted to, and I say this in the podcast too, if you wanted to like move my grandfather's grave somewhere else from the place where he's buried, you'd have to get permission from his next adult living relative. And in this case, it would be my grandmother, which is easy to find out because, you know, that's public record right now. But when you get back to people who died in 1879 or something, it's much harder to figure out. So the school district was under law supposed to get permission from next of kin, but they claimed that it would be too difficult to determine that. Or actually, they said I think it was impossible to determine who the next of kin would be. And so they chose not to do that. Instead, they sought permission from a judge, and the judge actually chose not to give them permission either. So, yeah, but as far as finding family members goes, we've embarked on that journey, just Naomi and I. And, it's a lot of intensive searching, but it's not impossible at all. We have the names of the convicts who died there. Actually, we have more than 95 names. We found up to 133, I think, people who could potentially be in that cemetery. And what you do is you just look up every record you can possibly find for that person, and try to find something about their life before they were convicted and sent to Sugar Land, and try your hardest to track down any sort of living relative. And we've done that for a number of people at this point.
Yeah, what did you learn about this guy, Jack Mitchell, who was among the convicts buried at the site?
Jack Mitchell is one of the first trees that I like really got into. I spent weeks, I think, with Jack Mitchell and his family. He was a father before he was arrested. He was married, and he was sent away for, I don't even remember what. I think theft, probably. And we learned that, his family stayed in Houston's Third Ward for generations until today. And we were able to track down through his son, through her, his son's daughter, and her son until today. We found a man named Terrence Price, who we talked to in our fifth episode. And he had no idea that this was part of his family history until we just called him out of the blue and told him so. So he was so surprised to learn that. But also, he was really, as sad as it is to hear this news and like as hard as it is to know this happened to somebody in your family, he was also just so grateful to be able to fill in that missing piece in his history. It's hard to know that this happened to you, but it's also just good to know what happened to you, how you got where you got.
Yeah, it's really tragic to think not only of these deaths themselves and the horror of that, but the way these people were functionally erased from history, erased from even their family's knowledge of them.
Yeah, I think a lot of the descendants that we've spoken to, have mentioned that, like issues of like abandonment or not knowing what happened in their history or not being able to trace their history very far back because of these gaps, people just disappearing in the family tree. And, it's interesting that convict leasing kind of fills in, reasons for that happening. We know that the mass incarceration is part of, the breakdown of the Black family. You always hear that, but it's not something that's just happening in the modern moment. Like, this is something that's obviously started in slavery, and then convict leasing contributed that to that as well. Men being worked to death, people not being notified. Even in the records, people when they're arrested, right, they're linked to Huntsville, so you don't know like what farm they worked at or where they physically potentially died. And so a lot of the descendants, I think, are just really thankful to have any information about these gaps in their history.
How was the decision made to bring Phoebe Stubblefield on board as part of the team investigating these remains?
So we consulted her after we had spoken to the group that was put in charge by Fort Bend ISD to do the investigation. So they hired Rain Clark, who was their archaeologist. They hired bioarchaeologist Katrina Banks Whitley and her team, and then a woman named Helen Graham volunteered to help with genealogical research. So that was Fort Bend ISD's like research team. And once we had spoken to them and heard how they went about doing this research, we wanted to just kind of know, as complete novices in these fields, if that was normal, basically. So we went to Phoebe Stubblefield, who is a researcher studying or trying to locate remains tied to the Tulsa Race Massacre in 1921, right? And she told us, as a Black forensic archaeologist or anthropologist, what she would do if she found remains and how she would go about studying them, determining their age, their race, their gender, all those things. And so that was just sort of our further look into that whole process and how those things work.
So this is not, as you've already said, an unprecedented situation. What happened in the late 80s and early 90s in Lower Manhattan?
Yeah, so that was the African burial ground where the US government wanted to create a building there. And similarly, during their construction, remains were found. And there was a huge response from the community there. And it became this very public situation, right? Where similar to what, we see with Sugar Land, conversations about moving them so they can create the government building, questions about how should we treat these remains, who do we consult, can we find descendants? And I think for them, it was even more difficult to talk about actual blood relatives because those remains were dated back to like the 1700s. And so ultimately, they did, I would say, the right thing and hired a bioarchaeologist or biological anthropologist, Michael Blakey, who at the time was at Howard University, I believe. So from the very beginning, they said, okay, this is a Black site. We need a Black scholar and expert to help us, not only do the science part of this, but also learn how to, engage the community, someone that will know the social and historical context of the people that lived at this time. And so you hear Michael Blakey talk about things that go far beyond biology or the bones, right? He and his team were looking at things like, what were the remains buried with? What were people, was there jewelry in there? Which is a very different approach than the team took that we interviewed for Sugar Land. But because of that situation, you hear a lot of people, including Reginald Moore, saying you should use the African burial ground as the model for doing this moving forward. And so ultimately, that situation turned into a beautiful memorial, right? The government building is not built right there. I mean, it did get built, but it's not built right on those bodies. I think people that are familiar with this, there is a lot of speculation with whether or not there are more bodies, right? One of the claims was that there's bodies all over underneath the city of New York. But that specific area got, reserved for a memorial. And it's, people can visit it. There's all kinds of art. And it's a public,
It's a national monument. Yeah.
right. Yeah, protected by the, I forgot the name of
I
the
think the
historic.
parks. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, that is like the perfect situation of how to respond to this. And out of that, that's where we got the notion of descendant community because Michael Blakey was the one that came out and said, okay, these remains are really old, probably not going to be able to find blood relatives. So we should really look at the people who are the most socially, culturally, historically linked to these people, and we should listen to them. And so that's why the Black community in Manhattan had the biggest voice. I would argue the biggest say in how to memorialize them.
So this group of bodies exhumed in Sugar Land, the Sugar Land 95, were eventually reinterred in approximately the same location. What kind of DNA evidence was extracted from those bodies before they were reburied?
And this is kind of interesting thinking about the African burial ground. When we spoke to Michael Blakey, who is like the foremost expert on these kind of burials, historically Black burials like this, he really stressed that, like, as an anthropologist or as an archaeologist, your first inclination should not just be, okay, let's dig, like, let's get in there, let's see the bones, let's study the bones, let's do all this stuff. That's not necessarily the right answer for every community. And he very much let that community decide what research they wanted done, what questions they wanted answered, and he let them drive all those decisions. And he said that the research that came out of it was like really rich and a great example of like what should be done in these cases going forward. So in Sugarland, when this happened, the same really didn't occur. The school district and their lawyers got permission from the court to exhume all of the remains. So they took them, all the bones out of the ground. They studied them, they washed them, they inspected them, photographed them, took some x-rays in some cases, and then they put them in cardboard boxes where they stayed for about a year and a half maybe. And at first, the school district was like, okay, since we can't identify them, let's do DNA testing. And rather than ask a group of descendants or a representative descendant community, like, hey, do you want there to be DNA testing? Instead, they just said, we want to do it. And ultimately, they ended up taking a sample of teeth and bone fragments from each of the graves and saving those, like pulling them out of the graves and storing them in an archaeological repository in Austin, and reburying the rest of the remains. So those pieces of the bodies are actually permanently separated from them.
Why were there concerns about the implications of testing that DNA? How did critics worry the information could be misused?
I mean, people had a number of concerns. One, to test DNA, you would need to also compare it to living people. So a lot of people wouldn't be willing to give that. I mean, I think there's a long history, as particularly in communities of color, not trusting those kinds of processes. But also, too, there was conversations from the leaders of the archaeology team talking about, oh, we could use these samples to do studies on sickle cell or other types of sort of culturally, I guess, marked diseases. And so they were concerned about that before, identifying anyone or getting input from anyone's descendant. And so that really does kind of make you think of other situations where Black bodies have been used for science. The Henrietta Lacks story. They're also doing this at a time when there's this conversation about universities, repatriating remains and bones to indigenous communities, Black communities, the situation in Philadelphia, that I think everyone's familiar with the they bombed that community, and then suddenly, I think it was, I might get this wrong, I think it was UPenn who still has those remains, and it's like, why do they have these remains? What are they doing with them? So for all of that to be going on, and then for the archaeology team's first interest to be all these sciencey questions, I think was very alarming for particularly the Black community.
So, how many bodies have been identified by name?
As far as like burial number one is John Smith or something like that, that hasn't been done at all because while the bone samples and teeth were taken from each of the graves for potential testing, that DNA testing is ongoing, I think in large part because, well, there's two big reasons. One, the school district and the archaeologists, the research team they hired, they haven't funded those studies. So they basically partnered with the University of Connecticut and to do DNA testing, and they didn't give them any money to do so. So the University of Connecticut has had to find funding on their own, which they're working to do and have done in some cases. But also, the researchers at the University of Connecticut want to be sure that they have the full faith and support of the descendant community before they're just releasing DNA out into public DNA databases, such as GEDmatch, which, speaking of Tulsa, those researchers have gotten a lot of pushback recently because sites like GEDmatch are publicly available for law enforcement to use. So if you're, a police officer in California and you're trying to solve a crime, you can put a DNA profile into one of these sites and get a historical match and get that link to somebody today. So especially in the Black community, people are really sensitive to that, and they're like, can you not be chronicling and putting all my DNA into a database like that? So the researchers at UConn, they have extracted DNA from the samples, and they're well on their way to sequencing that DNA. But as far as comparing it to living people or any other data sets, they're waiting for that sort of collaboration with a descendant community to get their not just approval, but their input on what they actually want to see done with these studies.
So ultimately, those 95 bodies were reburied. There was kind of an official rededication of this cemetery site, but Reginald Moore was not allowed to attend that dedication.
He was allowed, but he chose not to. The thing that he was not allowed to observe was the physical reburial. So there was a blessing the ground ceremony, which is like a memorial service that Fort Bend ISD did in, I want to say November or October 2019. And he chose not to go to that because he was just unhappy with how Fort Bend ISD was proceeding in reburying the bodies without first identifying their descendants. So he chose not to go to that. But as far as like actually reburying the bodies, so the funeral home came in and were doing the reburial physically. He tried to go and monitor that work just to sort of be a watchdog and make sure that it was being done respectfully. And he was asked to leave the campus by cops who were on the campus that day. And he was actually cited for trespassing.
He never gave up on this fight for justice and recognition. But people who knew him and cared about him feel like this really took a toll on his health.
Yeah, and we definitely get into that. His wife in particular talks about how this was, I think, it's a stressful and sort of sad and heavy narrative, but I would say the fight to memorialize or just get some sort of acknowledgement was the bigger stressor for him. I think the treatment from the school district, the local law enforcement, people dismissing him, anxiety about, okay, now these remains are unearthed. What's going to happen with them? Are they going to mistreat them? So I think all of that together contributed to his health issues. And some would say, because of his health issue being around his heart, that he sort of died of a broken heart, right? Because of the way that the Sugar Land 95 were being mistreated.
Has this story changed the way residents of Sugar Land and the surrounding areas think about their own history?
That remains to be seen. I know a lot more people know about it now. Even I, didn't know about convict leasing or the history of it in Texas before these 95 bodies were found. So I think it's definitely starting conversations, but Naomi grew up right near Sugar Land, so I think she has a better idea of like the general vibes there now.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think one of our goals with the podcast is hopefully that people in Sugar Land and Missouri City think about those spaces differently or have some more critical insight into, how those spaces came to be. But in particular, being a Black person from that area, I think it means a lot. I have family members that live in Sugar Land, and the initial reaction is obviously anger that you didn't know about this, but then the fact that it is getting talked about now and it's becoming curriculum in some ways, I think feels good to a lot of people, to know that this is not this sort of historyless white space, that Blackness is actually pretty foundational in Sugar Land, and as a Black person, I have a claim to a place that I call home.
What is next for this story? Is anything still unresolved?
I think a lot of things are still unresolved. We just wrapped up our last episode, episode 8, which comes out next week. And at the end, we sort of do a little "Where are we now?" thing. And we're in a really similar place to where we were, 5 years ago when the bodies were first found. There is still plenty of misinformation and cover-up going on in terms of how this narrative gets out and how it's presented to the world. There's a lot of inaction on the part of the researchers in charge, and a lot of push and pull and questions over control, who gets to control the bodies, literally, physically, who gets to control the history and how this narrative is told. It's very much still unresolved. And I think until descendant community comes together, or representative descendant community comes together and is put in real control over this story and this cemetery, not much is going to necessarily change for these 95 people and their legacies.
Journalist Brittany Martin and Naomi Reed are hosts of the Texas Newsroom podcast, Sugarland, which is available now. Naomi and Brittany, thank you for sharing this story.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having us.
You can find us on Facebook and Instagram and get the podcast wherever you get podcasts, or listen to it at our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.